ask about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Bruce Chard, and he'll be answering your most important questions on tarpon on the worm. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Bruce a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Bruce Chard about tarpon on the worm. When you stay at Tarpon Key Lodge in Belize, you are only a step away from fly fishing for tarpon, permit, and bonefish. In fact, you may see permit tailing right off the deck of your cabana. Tarpon Key Lodge is located on a private island just 45 minutes from Placencia. You can fish with world-class guides like Charles Leslie Sr., or make it a do-it-yourself trip and take one of the kayaks out and spend the day alone. At Tarpon Key Lodge, you fish the tides, not the clock, and that makes all the difference in the world. You can fish the lagoon for tarpon or the flats for permit and bonefish. It's your choice. If you're looking for that grand slam, Tarpon Key Lodge in Belize is the place to go. Book your next adventure now. Visit www.tarponkey.com. That's tarpon and then C-A-Y-E.com. Before we introduce Bruce, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. If you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Bruce's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a $25 gift certificate for Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. And you can redeem that certificate either in the store or online, your choice. So here's how you can win. You've got to be the first person to answer the question that I ask at the end of the show. And that question will be about something that Bruce and I talk about during the show. So just submit your answer along with your name and location in that text box on our homepage. And be fast about it. Be correct. And you may win that $25 gift certificate. Our guest tonight is Captain Bruce Chard. Bruce is a full-time Florida Keys Flats guide. For over 16 years, he has guided many anglers to their catch of a lifetime. Being a Federation of Fly Fishers Master Certified Fly Casting Instructor, Captain Bruce has conducted and taught many of his own personal fly fishing schools internationally and in the Bahamas, Guatemala, and all over the U.S. As a paid speaker at sportsman shows around the U.S., Bruce has had the opportunity to establish a working relationship with many of the largest companies in the fly fishing industries, leading to the development of the most specialized fly lines in the world. Bruce has also been featured in many major fishing catalogs with Ross Reels, G. Loomis Rods, Thomas & Thomas Rod Company, Riverborne Fly Company, Jim Tini Fly Line Company, Yellow Dog Fishing Adventures, and more. You can find Bruce on the cover of 5 major fly fishing magazines and numerous fly fishing articles and televised fly fishing shows. As a new innovative fly designer, some of Bruce's flies have been sold worldwide through Riverborne Flies. He has over 27 fly patterns available through Riverborne, ranging from bonefish, permit, and tarpon flies. Many more flies are being added to the Chard collection every year. Look for exciting things to come from Bruce in the future. Well, Bruce, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks for having me, Roger. Happy holidays, everybody, and thanks for joining in.
Yeah, sorry we had a little late start. We were having some technical difficulties. I was having some technical difficulties. And anyway, I hope we got them all straightened out, and I hope everybody is connected and listening. Why don't you give, if you're out there, if you can just give me a heads up saying, hey, can hear you in that text box on our homepage and send it on through, and then I'll be sure that we're communicating with you out there. Okay. Well, Bruce, lots of things to talk about tonight. I think what I want to start with is talking about tarpon in general and your experience with those. Still there, Bruce?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I know you're just kind of obsessed with tarpon, and I want to know why. Why is it so exciting for you, and after all these years, still exciting to guide your clients out to those huge tarpon?
Well, Roger, with my experience, you can never get enough. It doesn't matter how good of an or experienced angler that you are. You can never catch enough tarpon to be satisfied. Even on the very best trip that you could ever possibly have, it still is always such a challenge and so difficult to have everything come together to be able to put the fly in the right spot and coax that fish into eating your fly, and then trying to fight the fish and land them all to get to the boat. It's really, really hard to do that a lot successfully. And it always leaves the angler hungry for more, no matter what and no matter who you are. And the fact that they can grow over 100 pounds and smoke line off your reel like a cement, being hooked to a cement truck, going down the highway, and having no sense of control for a good portion of the entire fight. and of course, they jump out of the water, man. And when they jump that close or even far away and they're that big, it's something to behold for sure.
Yeah, I know. The few times I've been able to fish, it's been nothing. Even when I'm not catching fish, it's exciting. Just seeing the fish.
Well, that's another thing too. It's you're visually connected to these fish in gin clear water most of the time, and if you're in dirtier water and you can't see the fish, a lot of times you're seeing them roll on the surface because they have an air bladder like we do, so they'll supplement oxygen that they need to be active and to feed aggressively and to move by rolling on the surface, much like a porpoise, and taking in air. So you can see them on the surface rolling, and then water's clear and the lighting conditions are right, you can see them swimming through the water as well. As you can't beat that visual interaction, especially when it's a large fish. I mean, there's something about the size that really gets you going, too.
Yeah, it's something about sight fishing for a 20-inch trout in Colorado and sight fishing for a 50-inch plus tarpon or something. Yeah, I mean, it's like a little bit different, a little bit more exciting.
Well, another thing that makes tarpon fishing, along with all the flats fishing, so amazing is the lack of time that you have to think or process what's going on. So in anything in life, when you get to the very top level of any kind of sports or anything that you're doing, one of the main factors that makes it the top level is the fact that you have less time. I mean, you get to the major leagues in baseball, the baseballs are thrown faster and harder with bigger curveballs, and they're harder to hit because you have less time to do everything. So
this
is the Super Bowl. Tarpon fishing is a permit, bonefish, flats fishing, sight fishing. It does not usually and generally leave you much time to make many decisions. So your read and react skills along with your experience all come together quickly and hopefully help you take advantage of the opportunity that you have. But since it's so difficult to put yourself in a positive position with a good opportunity and all the planets aligning, you have to do it a lot to have those good opportunities be abundant. And that's why you can never get enough.
Yeah, the talking about knowledge, Andy Mill wrote a really stellar book on tarpon fishing, but I just picked up in the mail today again from a two-volume set on permit fishing from Perot, Wild River Press, and I'm going, oh, my gosh, there's so much information about that. You know, like you say, there's always, every day, there's something new to learn, right? I mean, it's really incredible. You're down in Florida, but tarpon exist elsewhere in the world, right? Where all can we find them that might be affected by the polluting worm we're going to talk about tonight?
Well, as far as the worms go, I'm not a scientist, so I like to share the experience that I have with the fishery just from what I have seen myself personally but talked to other people about. But I haven't heard of the Pololo worms being connected with tarpon anywhere else in the world other than in the Florida Keys.
Oh, really?
That does not mean it doesn't happen as far as the worm and the tarpon connection goes. But, you know, everything in the world eats those little worms when they hatch. And I know that they hatch in other places around the world where there are not tarpon. So
yeah,
there's other fish that are eating the worms as well. But as far as the tarpon and the worm connection goes, I have to believe after the last 25 years of guiding that I really believe the worms are the big reason why they push to the Florida Keys to spend time, because the highest number of visible fish that we have throughout the entire tarpon season is right at the Palola worm hatch time frame.
Yeah.
And once the hatches hatch, the fish numbers start to slowly depreciate and the fish start to move north. So it's kind of an interesting coincidence, if you will.
Where the tarpon that you have down in Florida kind of move up the East Coast and also around Florida up into the Gulf as well, right? I mean, don't they migrate
to the
Gulf for that? Yeah.
Yeah, they definitely have proof that happens for sure.
Yeah. So in Florida, where are you looking for tarpon? Where, you know, when you're out and taking your clients out, what kind of water are you looking for?
Well, believe it or not, one of the main reasons the Florida Keys are so good for tarpon is the Everglades and the freshwater flow that comes from the Everglades. If you go look up and down the east and west coast of Florida's and all the way up into the, you know, south of New Orleans and Louisiana and Mississippi, Alabama areas, northern Florida, all the Gulf areas are all affected by freshwater river systems. Mm-hmm. And if you look at all the main hot spots, Homosassa and Boca Grande and the Keys and even up near where the Mississippi Delta is, there's unbelievable tarpon fishing, all where there's a mass influx of freshwater mixing in with the saltwater. So I'm a pretty firm believer that they need that freshwater mixture for increasing the odds of their young surviving. So it's a pretty important part of that. Freshwater is key. So Florida Keys around the Everglades area is also really, really well known. West coast of Florida, all the way up the west coast, up into the Panhandle, supports all good tarpon runs. And then all the way over to the Mississippi Delta, even Texas, they have some pretty good tarpon fishing at times as well.
Now, yeah, and you say fresh water, I think, you know, like the Homosassa area has fresh water coming out of there, right? That's why that's so productive.
Well, all the main areas, Tampa Bay, Port Charlotte, where Boca Grande is, and Charlotte Harbor is loaded, Boca Grande Pass, all that has massive amounts of fresh water coming in from Lake Okeechobee and the Everglades and all the rivers up north of Tampa Bay and up in northern Florida. All have freshwater estuaries as well that come out, and it's a key factor for sure.
But they do have tarpon all the way down to the Key West, right? I mean, that's where I went.
Yeah, believe it or not, if you look on the chart in Key West, just 19 miles north of Key West is the Everglades.
That's it. Not that far.
No, and you have a massive, massive influx of fresh water that comes from there. And
yeah,
definitely affects the fishery in the Keys for sure.
So they like that kind of brackish water, not just total salt and not total.
Well, like I said,
uprivers too, right?
Yeah, oh, totally. I honestly believe that it really does have a the freshwater mixture balance with the salt is essential for them to have good luck with their breeding patterns and for their young to survive. Absolutely.
Yeah. So Dan from California asked, can he get a tarpon in the Florida flats from the beach or pier, or is it all, you know, do you always have to have a boat to get?
No, you totally can go from land. Yeah, like a lot of the bridges in the evenings, you can walk down underneath the bridges, and if you can find yourself a clear patch to make some catch, you can cast up current and swing your fly across into the pillars and get some fish that way. A lot of guys will waiting from the beach for giant tarpon, definitely can happen. You have to have just the exact right situation. You have to have really, really high tides, which allow the water to be fairly deep close to land. Then you can actually kind of wade from a beach. But if you do hook a big fish that way, it's really difficult to stay buttoned up on them. They're hard to stay buttoned up on anyways, but if you don't have the ability to to chase them down and get them on the fly line where you can really put mass pressure on the fish, and you're going to probably do more harm to the fish than good trying to wade fish for bigger fish. But smaller fish, usually under 50 pounds or so, a lot of times will jump themselves out. They'll jump more than they'll fight, and that's why a lot of experienced tarpon anglers actually thoroughly enjoy fishing for smaller tarpon, because then they don't have to factor in a longer battle.
So the larger ones will basically get you into your backing, and you end up following them with the boat, I guess, to, like you say, get the line back on your reel, huh?
Is that what the farther the fish gets away, you just can't put very good pressure on them.
Uh-huh.
And if you don't get on the fly line, if you don't get the fly line on the reel, and I mean, I even like to get the head of the fly line at least, there's 30 or 40 feet of line in the rod tip. It's really hard to put enough pressure on that fish to make a difference. And then you're going to take longer to fight that fish. And the longer it takes you to get fight that fish, the more lactose acid will build up in the fish, and then you'll have a harder time releasing it. His release survival rate will be much lower.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Obviously you want to try to land the fish quickly. But that's hard when he's fighting for his life, and
he's 120 pounds or something.
and then he gets in the current and goes down deep on you and all that jazz. So learning how to fight a fish correctly can really help you, especially if you're wading or fishing from land for the fish.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can talk a bit about that more later. Question from Jason in Ashland, Kentucky. He says, I do some musky fishing in eastern Kentucky, and I was wondering if the 10 weight that I use would be okay if I changed out the line, or do I need a whole new setup? So tell us a bit about the equipment that Jason might need, or that you like to see down there in the Keys.
Sure. When it comes to saltwater rods, usually the tip sections are, the top half of the rod is designed for casting, and the bottom half is designed for fighting fish. So usually in saltwater rods, you have a little more of a beefier or a stiffer butt section in the rod that helps you to apply more pressure to the fish when you're fighting them. So if you have a 10 weight that is stiff enough in the butt section, and you're throwing big musky flies, which those are big, heavy suckers to cast, so I bet you got a pretty strong 10 weight there, Jason. So you can totally use that rod for tarpon. There's no problem at all. And as long as you have a reel with a good drag system on it, you're going to be good to go. Like a nice hatch reel works the best in my experience. Being able to have a drag that you can virtually lock down when you need to, especially when the fish is close, is really, really important. And you can't have you're going to get what you pay for with a reel, and if you buy a lower-end reel, I'm not saying that you can't land a tarpon on that, because you totally can, but you could end up with a pretty nice fish on, and I've seen a lot of bad things happen when you're fighting tarpon. When they take off, they take off so fast, and the amount of heat that builds up inside the reel is what's the main concern. And if you don't have a good heat dispersing drag system on your reel, it will start to lock up, and bearings will start to crack and break, and bad things will happen. So depending on your reel is probably much more important than your rod, and also your fighting techniques than your rod. But you can totally get away with that 10 weight, Jason, no problem. Just like I said, as long as you have a good reel that got some good drag on it, you're good to go. The 10 weight, though, 10
yeah,
weight,
that's what I was going to ask you about. The 10 versus 11 or 12, where do you decide to make that break?
Right. Well, a lot of the experienced anglers use a 10 weight on calm days, even for big fish, because the line, the weight of the line is lighter, and it's just a more comfortable and easier rod to handle all day long. And a good experienced angler can, with good fish fighting techniques, can really do really well with a 10-weight rod. What I've seen happen in the last 10 years, especially mega in the last 5 years, is a lot of guys are moving from 12 weights to 11 weights, at least in the Keys they are. It's just people are learning how to fight fish better with the information that's out there in their experience, and you really don't need a 12 weight most of the time, for a large part of the time. So a 10 is like a lightweight, heavy tarpon rod for really calm days, and an 11 is probably the most all-around perfect rod, and a 12 can be good depending on what manufacturer you get. Some of the 12 weights that some manufacturers make are really, really light and act more like an 11 weight, and then some are really heavy and have foregrips and are really difficult and challenging to cast that are really super stiff. So you just got to kind of see which 12 weight you like best, and you can totally fish anything you want, but ideally right now everybody's going to like an 11 as a basic large tarpon rod setup for sure.
Mm-hmm. And so that would be your, you know, if you were to get one rod for tarpon, it sounds like the 11 weight is probably it. For all around fish.
Yeah, okay.
We had a couple of questions about casting, and you're a pro at casting and FFF certified and so forth. So Lanny in North Carolina asked, what kind of casting skills do you need for tarpon? And then Lance in Colorado asked about how to improve his skills to be ready for the salt. So you want to talk about kind of both those all together there?
Sure, totally.
What they need to have together to go down there?
Absolutely. So casting in general is basically your ability to have what I call loop control. So if you can make a cast and I say, give me a tight loop, and you actually can form a tighter loop, and then I say, give me a wider loop on the next false cast, and you do that, and then I say wider again, and you're able to do that, you're able to have what we call loop control. You're able to control the line in the air and make it do what you want. So true fly casting is being able to control the system, control the line in the air, form the size loops that you need, and all that together will help you achieve accuracy and get the fly where you want it to go. So it all starts out with, it doesn't matter how much power you have in your cast or what rod or reel you have or whatever, you need to be able to form loops and have loop control. And once you're able to do that, then all you need to do is add line speed, because you got to deal with the wind a lot in the tropics, especially for tarpon. So the faster you can move the line in the air and combine that with a tight loop, the more control you're going to be able to have, therefore allowing you to carry and control more line outside the end of the rod tip. So that will allow you to create more of a distance cast. So then you have your accuracy and your distance all combined. So to do that, just start out with practicing with a short amount of line, maybe 20 or 30 feet of line on the end of the rod tip. That's it. Nice short little stroke, and practice forming tight loops. And once you practice forming tight loops and you get that down pretty good, you can slowly increase your speed on your false cast and eventually work your way into being able to have a nice tight loop with extremely fast line speed. Then you'll be able to shoot more line in between each false cast with that tight loop and fast line speed, increasing the amount of line out of the end of the rod tip quickly, therefore reducing false casts and allowing you to get the line out of the end of the rod tip that you need to make the cast you need to make more quickly, and therefore creating an opportunity for you to take advantage of catching one of these fish, because remember we talked about a little bit earlier, you don't have much time when it comes to true sight fishing for tarpon. The quicker you can get the fly in the water on your primary presentation with your lead and cross, and then be able to come tight to your fly immediately with no slack and move the fly and present it on your secondary presentation where you're actually presenting the fly to the fish, the faster you can come to that point, the higher your odds go up right away for sure. So line speed is huge, and practice your loop control as well. And if you guys, if anybody has any questions on any of that, feel free to email me or call me. I love talking casting, and I'm happy to talk to anybody and help them out even over the phone.
Tell us about the loop control, tight loop versus a more open loop. What makes or doesn't make that happen for you?
Well, ideally,
people make.
Cool. Well, I'm going to try to keep it as simple as I can. So basically is this, guys. Your fly line follows the path your rod tip takes. So if you have 20 feet of line at the end of your rod tip, and you move your rod tip in a circle, the fly line moves in a circle. If you move the rod tip up and down really quick, then the fly line follows that same path and moves up and down really quick. So with just knowing that right there, when you go out and make your cast and you're practicing in your yard and you see the upper leg of the loop being very far away from the lower leg of the loop, that means your rod tip is traveling that distance. So if it comes off a straight line plane and creates a big arc, then that fly line is following that big arc, creating a wide loop. The less the rod tip moves in an arc or closer to a straight line plane, the fly line will follow that path on a straight line plane, therefore creating a tighter loop with the upper leg of the loop and the lower leg of the loop traveling very close to itself. And when that happens, a lot of the energy that you put into the system is condensed into that small, tight loop and wants to continue to travel.
And that can
Here's what happens.
The air.
When you make a normal cast, when you make a normal cast, what happens is the energy is contained within the loop. There's a lot to get that energy within the loop, but we're going to just keep it simple right now. But once the energy gets into the loop of the line, the way the cast is over is when the loop lays out straight and it unrolls straight, the cast is over. You don't make a cast and the loop lays out straight and your line lays out straight, and then your line, when it's already straight, continues to travel for another 30 feet. It doesn't. Once your loop has opened up, your cast is over. So wide loops don't go very far. Why? Well, because they open up immediately. Once they open up, all the energy is released, and the line doesn't know where to go anymore, and there's no more energy, so it just falls to the ground. So the tighter the loop is, the farther that loop will continue to travel with the amount of line that you have out of your rod tip. So you get more distance, and then, of course, you'll have greater accuracy because your loop is smaller and in a tighter area. So loop size is everything.
Okay, good. We need to take a quick break here, Bruce. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the importance of a double haul and how that will play into your casting. So we'll be right back. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as an unbeatable customer service and product support. They're best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly and Kodiak Rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They have been used by anglers and hunters all over the world for over 15 years, including Dave Whitlock, one of fly fishing's greatest innovators. Dave said, "With my Watermaster, I can enjoy more fishing per hour than any other method I have ever tried. After 2.5 years of testing 15 models of kickboats, I'm convinced that the Watermaster is the ultimate flotation craft for warm and cold water fly fishing." Visit Watermaster today and take a look at the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to BigSkyInflatables.com. That's BigSkyInflatables.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Bruce Chard about tarpon on the worm. If you'd like to ask Bruce a question, just go to our homepage at AskAboutFlyFishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Bruce, I always ask, hey, what's going on in your fly fishing world? Tell us a bit about what's happening in Florida, anything exciting, and about your business, how people can get a hold of you.
Yeah, cool. The Florida Keys right now is actually pretty good. It's like 82 degrees. And what a lot of people don't realize is that the tarpon are actually moving into the flats as we speak. So they're here when they usually come. Main tarpon season is usually, you know, March, April, May, and June. But the fish will come up whenever the weather's right. They don't have a calendar, so they have no idea what time of the year it is or what. So as soon as those cold fronts start coming in and those big north winds start blowing across the Gulf of Mexico, the fish start showing up in the Keys because it's nice and warm down there. And when the weather's nice in between cold fronts that come through, you can actually have possibly some of the best tarpon fishing you've ever seen, even better than primetime dates in May, because the good weather is few and far between, like I said, in between the cold fronts. And when you get those nice calm days just before the fronts stroll in and the water's warm, you have a nice southeast breeze, the tarpon fishing can be outstanding. So this time of the year is up and down with the fronts, so if you have fronts that stack up consistently, then you're going to have fewer opportunities to see, you know, some good tarpon fishing. But when the fronts spread out a little bit and there's time in between each front to warm up, then the tarpon fishing can get really, really good. So that's what's going on right now in the Keys. Permit 2 bones can be really good as well. The offshore fishing right now in the Keys is picking up big time with the wintertime fisheries, a lot of tuna and dolphin and sailfish. That's pretty exciting as well. But basically, if anybody wants to get a hold of me and ask me any more questions or talk some more fishing or some dates to go fishing, you can reach me at my email at captainpermit@aol.com. It's CAPTPERMIT@AOL.com. Or feel free to give me a call at 305-240-1335.
And, Bruce, you have a website, too, don't you?
I do. It's BruceChard.com. It's literally being reconstructed right now, so I'm not even sure every day the guy works on it. So you could see something different tomorrow than you did today. You never know. So check it frequently.
Okay, good. Well, thanks for sharing that all with us. Before we took the break, I was going to ask you about devil haul. Is that something that a person needs to know down in the salt water as well?
Absolutely. We talked earlier about how important it is to have line speed. Well, the devil haul is a very efficient way to increase line speed. If you're not totally familiar with what a devil haul is, a devil haul increases your line speed by pulling on the fly line with your line hand as your rod is loaded during your stroke, both your back and your forward stroke. So if you're able to haul as you make your stroke, forward or back, you're going to increase, load that rod even more, store more energy in it, and therefore increase your line speed. And anybody that learns how to double haul is going to never not double haul again, no matter where they go or whatever they do, and if they trout fish or steelhead or whatever, it will become a permanent part of your cast, which is actually very, very helpful in almost every type of fly casting for sure.
Yeah, it's I know what you're saying. I find myself doing it just unconsciously, you know, just on the lake or whatever like that when I'm not, even in the saltwater fishing. It actually, once you get the rhythm down, makes everything a whole lot easier, it seems like, if you're trying to get the distance. So, yeah.
Absolutely, with distance, but almost with everything. Just being able to carry and control different amounts of line in the air and really helps with having a double haul for sure.
Yeah. Let's talk about the worm, the Palolo worm. What is it? Where does it come from?
Well, the Palolo worm that happens in the Atlantic, well, first of all, there's Palolo worms all around the world. I haven't seen them anywhere else other than in the Keys because they always seem to hatch in the spring and early summer. And for the last 25 years of my life, I haven't been anywhere else other than in the Keys for spring and early summer. So, but what I've read is that they're throughout the Pacific, especially in the Samoa Islands, and the same time frame, late May, early June, these mass piles of worms kind of hatch out of the bottom of the coral or the sand bottoms. And what happens is, from my experience, is that they're really long, maybe 8 or 10 inches long, when they actually live in the sand or in the coral. And when you actually see the worms swimming on the surface while you're fishing, they're only maybe 2 to 4 inches long on average, and they seem to have a little white or tan or kind of yellowish kind of head. And what I've learned is that when they're 10 inches long in the coral, when they actually kind of hatch and the little worms that you see swimming on the surface actually break free from the main part of the worm, and the little worm then floats to the surface, those are the ones we see anyway. They're probably covering the entire water column when they actually start hatching pretty heavily. But obviously we see the ones that are on the surface most. And the regular worm, the rest of the worm, stays in its original hole and grows another head, if you will. Hmm. And what happens, from what I understand, is that they, at least from what I think in the Keys, is they all seem to wait to hatch on the strongest falling tides of the entire year in May. late May, early June. And what happens is the falling tide takes the water out to the reef about 3 to 4 miles offshore. So they want to get to the reef so they can spawn these little worms. So they know that every seagull and grouper and snapper and pinfish and tarpon in the world is going to be there to eat them. So they try to hatch close to dark when the light is low. And they also try to hatch when the tide strength is the strongest. So it helps them to get out to the reef as quickly as possible. And it's really interesting because these fish, you can watch the fish, they know when the worms are getting ready to start to hatch because they start acting differently and they start doing different things than their normal habitat allows them to do. So they swim sideways and upside down, and there might not even be any worms that you can see, but they might be trickling off on the bottom, which we can't see, and then that triggers the fish to start acting differently.
Yeah.
So,
is it the way you described it? It sounds like the worms are actually separating, and like you said, coming to the surface. So it's not like a hatch like we think of, you know, on a trout stream, but it's a different kind of propagation, I guess. Now, did these worms are going out to the reef to do what? To spawn themselves? Is that
correct?
What they're doing? Okay.
Correct. Although I have never seen myself on the reef the actual worms reproducing. So
you got to get closer to the water, Bruce. Down close. These aren't very big.
So I do a lot of nighttime tarpon fishing. And I've seen a lot of Palola worm hatches in March, April, May, and June in the middle of the night, 2 or 3 in the morning. And there's no reason for them to be hatching in that time frame that I know of because the tides aren't strong or anything, and they hatch and they're still swimming around. So I don't know. They seem to be smaller. Those worms seem to be a little smaller, but they're definitely Palola worms, no doubt. But the main hatch usually is in late May, early June, in the evening, and super, super strong falling tide to help them get out to that reef.
So so you say in the evening. And then how long does the hatch last? I mean, is it hours?
Well, usually there's only one or two what we call main hatches, where the hatch starts, worms start to trickle in the tide, maybe 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and they'll go all the way till dark, about 9 o'clock. But there's tons of what we call mini hatches. And a lot of times a little patch of an area on the bottom, I'm guessing, or something, decides to let loose on the worms, and they might only go for 15 minutes at 8 o'clock for whatever reason. And then all hell breaks loose, and every tarpon in the world's eating all these worms, and then all of a sudden they stop, and all the fish are gone. So if you don't fish every night, all night, and stay out and look, there's a good chance you might miss a lot of the what we call mini hatches. And that's one year I hit 16 total hatches, and 12 of them were all mini hatches, and then we had 4 that were some pretty big main hatches. So that was a really good year. And then a couple years ago, I think there's only 1 main hatch and 1 trickle hatch for the season, and that's all we had. So it definitely is something that we can predict pretty good, but on the other hand, maybe not so much, right? Definitely a time frame of the year we can predict it, and we can look at the tides and figure out when the best odds of them happening and hatching are going to be. But a lot of it has to do with water temperature and current weather, I've noticed as well.
So let's take a quick break. I got a bunch of questions yet, so let's take a quick break. All
right.
Come right back and ask more questions. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing and, trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com. That's dryflies.com. And view the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services, and they have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Bruce Chard about tarpon on the worm. If you'd like to ask Bruce a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll try to answer as many of those as possible on the show tonight. Bruce, you know, okay, you say you know about it might happen this month. You're going to look for those tides going out, but what is the is this happening all up and down the Keys throughout Florida, or is it only in particular places?
As far as I know, I've only heard of them hatching and throughout the Florida Keys, from Miami down to the Marquesas.
Okay.
And I got to believe it has something to do with the shallow water flats ecosystem that the Keys has to offer.
Okay.
I'm pretty
sure.
Does
the word just get out amongst the guides that all of a sudden everybody's talking about the worm hatches? I mean, is it just one of those things?
Well, it's funny you say that because fish will start to change their normal habits when they're going to start worming.
Oh.
So at that time of the year, a lot of the tarpon are swimming along the ocean side of the Keys, migrating up and down the Keys. Nobody really knows what they're doing when they swim up and down. But a lot of times they'll swim both directions. And when it comes to getting close to the worm time, they'll start to slowly only swim in one direction. And then once they start doing that, they start not eating at all. They won't eat a fly at all. They'll shy away from any kind of fly you throw at them. And not eat at all. So you might get a whole bunch of shots and have a really great day of fishing and see a lot of fish, but you won't get very many fish to pay attention to what you're showing them. Then that's another sign. And then all of a sudden, they miraculously disappear. And you're like, okay, well, yesterday we saw hundreds of tarpon pumping through on this section of the tide, and now there's nothing. Well, that's because they're all where the worms are going to be, and they're not leaving. They're all hunkered down in the main
channel. With their fork and knife and fins, right? Right? They're just
yeah, buddy. For sure. So, yeah, those are some key things we can tell with the fish when things are starting to get a little wormy. But also, any kind of positive weather change that would help the worms get to the reef a little safer, right? So, like, we might have a calm day that has a low ceiling of clouds and overcast gray, man, they could start hatching early in the middle of the afternoon with that because of the low light. They like the low lights because I think they believe that predators have a harder time seeing them. And I believe that's true because on the main worm hatches, we'll see the big tarpon go nuts on the worms. But once it starts to get too dark, we can shine the light in the water and we can see worms everywhere, but the fish are not eating them anymore. So I kind of believe they have a hard time seeing them once it starts to get a little too dark, which is why the worms choose to hatch a little later in the evening, in my opinion.
So do you change your whole guide schedule at that time of the year and take your clients
yeah.
out in the evening? Is that what happens? Yeah.
Of course. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Interesting. So you said other things are eating those worms, too, besides tarpon. Do you end up getting the other hookups with other kinds of fish, just incidentally? Or?
Yeah, sometimes we'll get some snappers, some jack crevalles. Very rarely, but sometimes even a bone or a permit, for sure. But everything is eating these worms, for sure. And depending on where your fly is in the water column will depend on what odds of getting that type of fish, right? So if you go a little deeper, you might get a grouper or snapper to take your fly. If you stay higher in the water column, you're probably going to get more odds of getting a tarpon or
okay.
a bird. But, you know, humans even eat them. Some of the anglers in the Keys like to throw them in their, you know, bottom of their tequila and drink them up and stuff like that. But apparently over in Samoa in the Pacific, they squish them all up and make them into a like a bread loaf and like a, mix it with coconut and they have a loaf and it's kind of sacred to them, I guess, at certain times of the year. So they'll use a big seine net, you know, from boat to boat and scoop them all up and squish them up into a big mush and make bread out of them pretty big
delicious.
Thing for them. I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, my mouth is watering right now.
Yeah, right.
You had mentioned you did an article in Fly Fisherman magazine not too long ago on the Palola worm hatch, and you had mentioned in there that you were thinking, and I guess you might not be absolutely sure about this, but thinking that this hatch also has to do with when tarpon might spawn. Has there been any more research on that, or can you tell us about that?
No, well, not that I know of, but, you know, I had a friend of mine, Captain Joel Dickey, made a really cool, interesting comment to me one night. He was watching Shark Week, and they were talking about the great white sharks and how they were eating on this big whale carcass and how they would gorge themselves to the point where it would force them to want to spawn or breed. And I started talking to some hunters about this, and they all started telling me about how, like, elk and deer and such will really load up on the extra protein right before they start to mate as well. So it's some sort of a extra protein in the system gives them maybe some extra boost to feel confident that that's going to go into their young and make them really strong or give them the extra strength they need to actually go through the breeding process. So the worms are definitely a huge source of protein for these fish. And usually after a main worm hatch where the worms go nuts for 4 or 5 hours and the tarpon can definitely get their fill, they disappear. A lot of times for 2 or 3 days you won't see them. So here you are, you're thinking you're coming at worm time, and you get here the day before, or the day after the worm's main hatch, and then all the tarpon disappear. They're all out on the reef, and there's only one reason they're out there, and that's to, you know, reproduce. And there's no doubt in my mind it's triggered by the worm hatch and the massive amount of protein they're eating.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, in the reading I've been doing the past few months on both also on bonefish and tarpon, you know, they're not too sure about what they do as far as their spawn either. And but a lot of what I've read is that they think they go out to the reef as well, I mean, to the deeper water to spawn, even though, you know, they spend most of the time in the flats. But when that time comes, they go out there for whatever reason. And so it seems like a lot of flats fish will, they think, do go out there to spawn in the deeper water. So that's
absolutely.
Yeah. So you said before, you know, just before the worm hatch, all the tarpon disappear, and that's because they've, you know, like I said, have their fork and knife ready and their plate over to wherever the worms happen. So where is that? I mean, is that in the channels, you know, between the keys, or where's that tide moving that you look for the worm hatch to happen?
Well, you have tide moving everywhere, but the water flows more swiftly in between the islands where the big deep water channel cuts are. So there's so many fish that stack up that they have to fight for feeding lanes. So the more water and the more depth there is, the more area there is per fish to feed effectively. So not only that, since there's more water that funnels through those channels, higher odds of more food being funneled through those areas as well. So they go and they hang out in high oxygenated, high moving water and have a great odds of getting more food. So why not? Let's all go there. So that's what they do.
And that's happening all up and down between the Keys from, like you say, Miami to Key West, huh?
Correct.
Okay. And is that and you're out in your flats boats targeting the tarpon at that point?
Sure. Yeah, we A lot of times the fish will swim along the channel edges of these deep water travel trenches and channels, and you can actually pull the flat, and on higher tides they'll move right up along the edges of the flats as they come in and out of that channel. A lot of people might think that they swim, you know, down low in the bottom and swim out, which some of them probably do, but a lot of them do travel the edges. And you can have some good shots at fish along the edges of those channels for sure.
And are you targeting them mainly at the surface, or where in the water column are you fishing?
Mostly close to the surface, yep. There, you can definitely throw a sinking line if you want, but the lower you go, the more you take away the visual aspect of it, and that's what's really cool about sight fishing for tarpon.
So yeah, that picture you had in your article of it looks like a, you know, a twilight shot by the bridges and the tarpon rolling, and that wasn't photoshopped, I take it, huh?
Well, that was Captain Joel Dickey. That was Captain Joel Dickey's picture. He did a great job of that one. That's a beautiful shot. And
it looks surreal. You know, it really does look surreal. That's why I joke about it. But
when the evening sun gets a good angle, you get some unbelievable colors that come across the water, especially if it's calm. It seems to reflect just like a mirror. So you get some beautiful opportunities to take some great pictures for sure.
But some of these fish are really, you know, really out of the water too. Which I thought was interesting. I
mean, the deeper the water is, the higher they'll come out and roll out of the water. Let me rephrase that. The deeper the fish are in the water column, the more they'll, when they roll, the more they come out of the water to go back down, to angle themselves to go back down deep. So if you see a tarpon and it's rolling kind of quick and then turns sideways and kind of comes high and up out of the water, it's usually angling so it can go right back down to the bottom. If it rolls really, really, really slow and happy, what we call happy, that means he's staying really high in the water column and is going to be pretty susceptible to eating and eating your fly. So fast rollers that are going deeper are more challenging to get to eat your fly.
Okay, let's take another quick break, and then when we come back, let's talk about, you know, your presentation techniques, how you get these guys on the hook. So we'll be right back. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Bruce Chard about tarpon on the worm. If you'd like to ask Bruce a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A box to send us your question. Okay, Bruce. So the fish are rolling out there. We're ready to hook up. First of all, what kind of terminal tackle do you, you know, what's your setup for that when you're fishing for the tarpon with worms?
I use all floating lines, just my normal 11, 12, or 10, 11, or 12 weight rods, and a good fly reel with a great drag system on it, and you're going to be good to go. What I believe is most important.
About the tippet and leader situation, what do you got?
Yeah, I was just going to say what I believe is the most important part is the leader system. So depending on how deep you want the fly to go, and or allow it to go, or how you want it to swim in the bottom or in the water column is going to depend on how you tie your leader up. So I personally like to use extra long leaders, up to 15 feet long.
Oh, wow.
Because that allows me to get deeper in the water column if I want to by throwing up current a little bit, and that allows the fly to be a little further away from the floating line and allows it to get a little deeper, and sometimes that can make a difference on getting a take depending on what the fish are doing and what weather we're fishing in. So when the water is choppy because it's windy, it's harder for the fish to see the fly. So we have to strip the fly a lot slower and almost even hold it in the current at times
just to give the fish a chance to actually see your fly instead of through all the other fly, little pleworms that are swimming by. So as the fish are swimming, they're looking for the worms, and there's so many worms that they don't have to move much. They just keep swimming in a straight line, and they're going to continue to find tons of worms as they swim straight. So if your fly is not directly in front of the fish when they swim by, they won't eat it. They're not going to move over 2 feet to go eat your fly when there's 6 more real worms right in front of their face. They just keep swimming straight. So if you realize that and understand that, your ability to know exactly where your fly is in conjunction to where the fish is going to be vital, your ability to hook up during the worm hatch. So a lot of the time I see guys in there stripping really, really fast because they see the fish coming through and they're pulling the fly through real fast. Well, if you just break that down and think about it yourself, if you saw a bunch of worms out in front of you and one was getting ripped through there really fast and there was 3 other ones that were just sitting there, you're probably going to just eat the other 3 worms that are just sitting there. They're a lot easier. You don't have to chase down the one that's moving really fast. So it's just a little common sense, and just strip really, really slow. Keep that fly in the water column right in front of the fish. And whether it's moving or not, a lot of times they just eat it because it's right there in front of them.
So are you actually sight casting to a specific fish in most cases, or is it just moving through a school, so to speak?
Both, and even blind casting at times. So a lot of times the fish will school up, and they'll be shoulder to shoulder, maybe 20 feet wide, and they'll be kind of what I call steamrolling and rolling hard and kind of coming at you, or across or wherever, and you can throw your fly out in front of all those fish and move it across the front of those, and your odds go up high, you know, if you have a big wide spread of fish in front of you. But a lot of times, though, that pack of fish will swim by, and in between that time when the next one comes by, you can kind of make a couple blind casts and just kind of swing your fly or fish your fly through an area where you don't see many fish. And a lot of times where you don't see the fish, you'll end up catching one because there's fish that are feeding below the surface on worms that are below the surface of the water as well. So a lot of times guys will get so excited and they see the fish rolling and busting over to the right. They'll make a cast to the right, and right when the fly lands, they'll see one bust over to the left, and they immediately pick their fly right back up and throw it over to the left. And they continue to do that over and over again because it is pretty exciting. There's fish everywhere feeding all around you, and you want to, you know, you just saw a big fish bust a worm over to the left, and you want to get it over there right away, but your fly is in the air 80% of the time versus in the water 80% of the time.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I like to just strip slow and swing and keep the fly in the water, even if I don't see any fish where my worm fly is. And then I have a really high odds of getting fish that way as well.
Now, when you're, from the sounds of it, you've got a pretty good current going through there. Is it a noticeable current? In other words, can you float your fly with the current? Is it like fishing?
Sure.
Big river in the west or something?
Absolutely. You can totally do that. Yep. A lot of guys will drift, and they'll cast as they drift, covering ground that way. A lot of guys will anchor up, and then that allows you to work the moving water as like a river. So you can throw upstream and do a mend, and you can throw equal with the current and do a strip back with the current, or you can let it swing down current and hold tight. You can do any and all that above. And if you want to get deeper, you can throw a sinking line in there as well and get down deeper, throwing up current and getting down really low and swinging the fly down current. That all works as well. But the main thing is just keep the fly in the water versus being in the air.
And Joe Herndon in Richmond, Texas, want to know what kind of retrieve you're using during these presentations.
Well, the key word, Joe, is slow.
Keep it
in the water. Move it really slow, and your odds of having a fish seeing it go up. The faster the fly moves through the water, the less the fish is going to want to try to chase it down because they just don't need to. They don't need to exert any more energy when food just constantly comes by their mouth. Why would they just especially swim over to the left or to the right or whatever to just to take a worm, your worm fly that's moving quickly?
Yeah.
So just try to have a good sense of what your fly is doing and just make sure that it's moving really slow, and you'll increase your odds of getting a bite for sure.
And what are we looking at as far as fly patterns? Are there commercially tied Palolo worm patterns, or do you tie your own, or what are they? What do they look like?
Yes, to all the above.
Okay.
There's different sizes of worm flies that I've found on small ones and big ones, and ones that float on the surface with foam, and ones that dive with weights on them, and there's some that look like, you know, little gummy worms, and they work well. Guys tie up flies with little chunks of anything that's red. They'll cut a rubber band, you know, red rubber band, and just tie it on a hook, and they'll catch them on that. It really is, and all different sizes, too. It really doesn't matter, especially when the worm hatch is going off. There's lots of worms. It's all about your presentation versus what fly you have. So a lot of times in the last couple, 3 years, though, we have been going to smaller hooks at least, even though the fly is actually, you know, the same size. It's just going with a smaller hook, though, to make sure that the fish can not see the big hook. It makes a big difference. But when it's windy and choppy and blowing all over the place with weeds, seagrass flopping in the waves as well, a bigger fly is usually is helpful because then they can pick that out from the grass going by and the chop as well.
I still don't know if I can picture what a Palolo worm looks like, but is it similar diameter to some of the big earthworms, those rubber earthworms they use for bass fishing? Is it anything?
Exactly. Well, a little smaller diameter than a bass worm.
Oh, really?
You can get some. Yeah, I would say a little smaller than a pencil.
Oh.
And about half the size of diameter of a pencil, and about 2 to 3 inches long, and they're like a peachy creamy red, and their head is a tan or a little yellow kind of a color. And I've heard that the females have the chartreuse kind of yellowish kind of head to them, and they're actually really cool looking on the head side. So I tie some flies with little chartreuse heads, with pink heads, with tan heads, with rusty colored heads. They're tarpon, they're fish, they have small brains. They're smart, but they're not that smart. So, I mean, you can definitely be creative on the vise and use all kinds of different materials with those color patterns and probably catch fish, no problem. As long as your hook is not too big.
Yeah, just going to ask you about that. You said you were moving to smaller hooks, so what size hook are you tying these on?
Well, a lot of the main tarpon hooks are tied on like 1/0 and 1s right now. So using a smaller hook for sure, like those sizes, are going to be very helpful. Some guys still use really big hooks, though, 3/0 or 4/0 or even 5/0, and that's just going to be way too big. It makes the fly not ride right. It makes it sink at an angle that doesn't look natural. The key to a tarpon fly is to make it swim buoyant in the water system. So you want it to, you know, not sink, and you don't want it to ride up at an angle. You want it to stay buoyant, at least while the fish locks in on it and follows it. If it stays buoyant during that time frame and it continues to look good to them, that's what makes them eat the fly. If you strip too fast, the fly will ride up at an angle, and if you strip too slow, the fly will sink even while you're stripping it. And both of those motions will definitely turn the fish off.
And what's the take like?
Well, it depends. A lot of times when you're stripping the fly really slowly, you can barely feel anything at all. You feel like a little bump. And you just continue to strip nice and slow until you come tight to the fish. And then you really don't even set the hook that much. You can kind of pull back once you come tight and set the hook. But what we don't want to do is drive that hook into the bone. So what I like to do is just kind of come tight, let the fish feel the resistance, and then start to swim away. And as he starts to swim away, since you haven't hammered on him immediately once you felt the bite, you didn't drive that hook point into the bone in his mouth. So it starts to slide. And as that hook slides across the inside of its mouth, it slides to a soft cartilage area where it then can bite and dig in. And then once that happens, you hold on tight and really set the hook into that softer area. And then you're off to the races. You really have a really high odds of at least not having the fish spit your hook out when you fish them and, with that type of technique. If you hammer them right away, right when you feel something, you're going to try to drive that hook point into that bone in their mouth. And it'd be like trying to set a hook into the concrete in the Kmart parking lot. Good luck with that. And he's going to probably going to jump right away, and when he does, he's probably going to have a good chance of spitting the hook. But if you don't set the hook and you just come tight and stay tight, allow that hook point to pull across the hard bone, find a soft spot, your odds are going to go up immensely of landing that fish.
Yeah, that's a really, I don't know that delicate is the right term, but careful way of setting the hook. I mean, what you described makes total sense to me, but in the heat of the battle, you know.
Yeah. I was just going to say, it takes experience to be able to hone that excitement. You know, when you get a bite,
yeah.
You're like, oh, I got one, and then you go to set the hook really hard, and you try to drive that hook point right into the bone, and then the fish jumps and spits the hook, and away you
go. Yeah. Yeah, and what's, you always hear the term bow to the tarpon when you get hooked up. So tell us about that as far as fighting the tarpon.
Well, in my personal opinion, I don't believe it's necessary to worry about bowing to the tarpon that much.
Okay.
In my opinion, the bowing to the tarpon is to help give a little bit of a shock to, or a little bit of a, I wouldn't say shock, a little bit of a give to the system when the fish is far out and he starts to jump. So when the fish jumps, it has to accelerate to do so. And if you have a lot of line out, so you've got a fish 100 yards out, about 100 yards of backing, you got your whole 100 feet of fly line and the leader as well, when the fish is just normally swimming, especially if he's swimming into the current, there's a ton of pressure on all that line under the water. So if he accelerates to try to jump, that's going to put even more pressure on the line. So imagine if you're standing in a swimming pool and you take your right hand, you cup it behind you, and you're in waist-deep water in the pool. And your objective is to swing your whole arm in a circle around like a windmill. And when you have your hand cupped and you hit the water, it's hard. It's really resistant, but you're pushing through it really hard. And when you come forward and you break your hand from the surface of the water, it just accelerates immensely because there's no more restriction from the water resisting your hand movement. Well, the same thing happens to the tarpon. So he's swimming along, and there's already a lot of tension on the fly and the leader system because of how much line he's got out. Then all of a sudden he accelerates. All right, now the line's really screaming and trying to, you know, to not break. And then all of a sudden he actually breaks the surface of the water and accelerates even more. So all of that acceleration is putting a ton of pressure on that leader. And your ability to step forward, jab with your rod arm out, and bend over as much as you can to give as much slack in the system, create some sort of cushion there to help relieve a little bit of pressure on your tippet. That's why we bow to the Silver King. Because if you don't do that and you hold on tight and you're jamming on him still the whole time, good chance that he's going to break you off.
That's probably the best description I've ever heard of the whys and wherefores of how that all works. Very good.
Cool.
Yeah, made total sense to me. So let's say we're getting down on time here, and we're almost done with the fight here. So let's say we're fortunate enough to get him up to the boat. What are your tips on handling the fish and getting a good photo so we don't hurt the fish? Lives another day.
Well, believe it or not, it's law right now. You're not actually allowed to take a fish out of the water right now. So
okay.
unless you have a kill tag for the tarpon. So basically what happens is I would not recommend using a gaff, especially don't use a gaff at all. I haven't used a gaff in over 20 years. So they have a hand, just like a big bass, they have a big lower jaw that's got a big bone around the whole jaw. So once you get the fish close to the boat, you want to make sure that whoever is helping you land the fish, or if you're doing it yourself, you're going to grab the leader with your hands to help added pressure and steer the fish in a manner that will allow you to have the fish lay sideways parallel with you along the boat, okay? You do not want to grab the leader and pull the fly towards you where the fish is coming at you from below or coming at you from the side, because if that fish decides to kick his tail even a little bit at any given time and kind of take his head out of the water, he'll literally shove his lower jaw right through your throat and bash your face in. So it's really actually pretty dangerous unless you have the fish parallel to the boat. If you have the fish parallel to the boat where the head of the boat, head of the tarpon is actually facing away from you when you go to put your hand in his mouth, much safer for you to do it that way than to have the fish pointing at you. So this is when a lot of rods break too. So when the angler swings the leader in towards the boat and the guy that's going to land the fish grabs the leader, I like to always recommend that the anglers pull their rod tip high and pull line off their reel at the same time, but staying tight with the line and the leader through their rod tip, okay? And extending their rod arm high up in the air to create a very large and wide angle of their fly rod, up and high and staying tight with their line all the time. The reason why is the leader is touched by the guy that's landing the fish. By no means is that fish landed. So many times if the angler will lower his rod tip and go, oh, thank goodness, and just put slack in the system, the line or the leader will wrap around the tip. The slack will wrap around the tip of the fly rod. And then the angler loses, the tarpon will kind of break, will fight and thrash a little bit and break free from the grasp of the guy that's landing the fish and start to take off really quick, and therefore your line is wrapped around your rod tip. There goes your whole rod tip and maybe even the fish as well. So keeping your rod tip high and tight at all times with a big wide angle to not put too much bend in the tip will help you from breaking your rod tip and also help you from tangling the line around the tip with any loose line at all. So, and then allows you to keep the good pressure on that leader while the guy is trying to land the fish for you. And it helps him as well to know where the line is all the time. It's always going to be angled up and high, so it's easy for him to grab it if he loses his grasp of it. And then when you are able to bring the fish in close after you've hand brought in the leader and you're tight and you can grab him by the lower jaw and he's going to thrash really quick, but if you got good strong hands, just hold on to him really tight. And he'll thrash probably once or twice, and then he'll probably say, I'm done. And he'll lay broadside with you. That's the time I like to put the boat in gear slowly, just idle slowly, to keep his tail up high and keep him from sinking down. He's going to be really tired, so if you keep the boat moving slowly, you can keep water going through his gills while you take the fly out. And if you lay him sideways as you do that, they kind of just lay really nice. And sideways is a great place, great way to take a photograph of the beautiful fish laying sideways like that next to the boat. Mm-hmm. Can't beat it.
Wow, thorough. Yeah, a lot to it. That's why you need a professional guide with you to take care of that.
Help.
Yeah. Not something you do every day if you're not guiding. That's for sure. Yeah. Well, good. Sounds good. Well, you took us on quite a journey Bruce. I appreciate that. We've got we've run out of time here, but stick with me for a few more minutes, and we've got some great prizes to give away: a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and a $25 gift certificate to Front Range Angler. So stick with us a few more minutes, and we'll be right back, and we'll give away those prizes. A mining company called Pac Rim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. The Chewitna Coal Project would be the first project in Alaska history to mine directly through salmon habitat, the Chewitna River drainage, 11 miles of it. Critical commercial, sport, and subsistence fishing economies would be permanently destroyed. Pac Rim says it can rebuild a salmon stream, but scientific experts could find no example where successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chewitna Coal would be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. It's time to stop the Chewitna Coal strip mine. For more information on how you can help, go visit www.chewitna.org. That's C-H-U-I-T-N-A. C-H-U-I-T-N-A.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link under our homepage in the section of tonight's show that says, what do you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. So now it's time to give away a few prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, then it's too late now, but you have plenty of time to do that for the next show. So do that, and you'll have a good chance of winning one of the great prizes we have to give away. And, okay, so the first thing we're giving away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. If you're not familiar with the Federation, go check them out at fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. And they do a lot of great work, and certainly it's a great way to look for a fly casting instructor in your area, right, Bruce?
Yes, sir.
If you want to brush up on your skills for the saltwater, that's where you can find some great instructors. Okay, so our first winner is, let's see here, Jeff Stevens in California. Jeff Stevens, congratulations. You just won yourself a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And Jeff Stevens, he's in California, so congratulations, Jeff. And next up is a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and that is courtesy of AmatoBooks.com. And so if you want to see what else Amato has out there for periodicals and or books, check out their website at AmatoBooks.com. And our winner there is Joyce Deming in Colorado. So congratulations, Joyce, and hope that will serve you well for learning how to tie some great flies. So congratulations. Okay. Now, give away that $25 gift certificate. Let's see here. The question for tonight, we'll break it off of the Palolo worm, but Bruce talked a lot about control and fly casting, and what was the probably the most important thing he talked about as far as being able to penetrate the wind and the conditions out on the salt flats. So what is that one thing that you want to be doing when you're throwing those casts out in, for tarpon? So let me know what that is, and get yourself a $25 gift certificate. And I'm wondering whether this is working or not out there because, let me see.
Not too much feedback.
Well, yeah, I didn't get any questions in during the, I just got one saying I could hear you at the very beginning, and then we didn't hear anything. So I'm going to just check it out here real quick. Oh, yep, there it's working. Tight loop, is that it, Bruce?
Well, that's one of them, that's for sure.
That's a big one. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll give that to Danny and Dan in Sunnyvale, California. So congratulations, Dan. And Dan, just send me your, I'm not sure they need that or not, but send me your address in the information box so that we have that. And we'll send that over to Front Range Anglers to get you that $25 gift certificate. So thanks for playing. Thanks, everybody, for playing and joining us tonight and listening in. And thank you, Bruce, for being with us again and talking about the Palolo worm. It was very interesting, and it sounds like not very many of us will ever get to partake of that, but if we do, it'll be exciting for sure. So thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Roger. Happy holidays, guys.
Yeah, same to you.
Take care.
On our next show, which will be January 4th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, on that show I'm going to interview Devin Olson. And our topic for the show will be tactical nymphing, Euro style. Devin is a medal winner, member of the Fly Fishing Team USA, and he shares the modern-day nymphing techniques that he and Lance Egan use to catch fish in the European style. When competing on an international basis, you have to be good. You have to know how to adapt. So join us to find out how it's done. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Tarquin Key Lodge, Watermaster, Front Range Anglers, and Housatonic River Outfitters for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing. I hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.